The Jerry Doyle Show.
I heard a rumor that our guest Anita Finlay, author of Dirty Words on Clean Skin, books, by the way, spent 16 weeks in the number one position on Amazon's Women in Politics list, the book about Hillary Clinton. I heard a rumor that Anita is going to be out at the Hamptons this weekend with the Clintons in their new $200,000 a month beach rental. I don't know if that's true. Anita, is that any truth to the rumors I'm hearing that you're Hamptoning this weekend with the Clintons?
Oh, sure, and I'll be making all the lemonade for these people. Absolutely.
I love the story from the standpoint that they're renting a $200,000 a month Hampton home from a Republican donor named Michael Saperstein. So they can get along. There can be bipartisanship in politics when they're willing, the Democrat Clintons, to spend $200,000 to rent a home for a month from a Republican donor. See, that's a place where we can find commonality.
They're just spreading the wealth around.
$200,000 a month for a beach rental. Even if I had the Clintons' money, I don't think I could justify $200,000 a month.
No, I think that's crazy, but, you know, that's no different from what the Obamas spend much more on their vacations. It's no different from what some Republicans do. I mean, I think that when people are in a certain class or they have a certain amount of money, you know, here it is. And we also have to take into consideration that there are certain security considerations that you and I would not have.
Yeah.
That perhaps they do. So, you know, we have to be realistic about that. That also plays into it, that they can't go anywhere without sort of being invaded or set upon. So that's another thing.
Yeah. Well, what about, you know, you point out that the Obamas and the president, you know, I hate when Fox News beats up on the president's golfing, the president's taking a vacation, you know, all that kind of nonsense. But it's where they vacation. Is it really not an insight into the great divide between the haves and the have-nots, the political class and the rest of us that are trying to slug it out? You got the Obamas out on Martha's Vineyard. You got the Clintons out on a beachfront home in the Hamptons for $200,000 a month. And any other number of past presidents and people that are politically motivated or politically well-connected that seem to be going to places that we only get to read about in Travel and Leisure magazine.
Well, you're hearing about the divide that is greater in this country than ever in terms of who has money and who doesn't. I mean, as you and I have spoken about before, the stock market is booming, but that's not really translating out into the real economy because we're experiencing a lot more part-time employment and, you know, that means a cut in benefits or no benefits at all. And we're just sort of, we've become the viewer class. You know, we get to do what you just said. We get to watch it on TV and wish we had it, but we're no closer to having it. And in fact, we feel further away.
Yeah, it's all about the economy and jobs. At least that's what they tell us. But I know a lot of people out there, 57 million native-born Americans that are available to work, and they're ready to go to work. But the jobs are very problematic because there doesn't seem to be enough of them to go around. Speaking of jobs, there was an interesting story in CNN Money. The headline is, Why 26% of U.S. Women Still Choose Not to Work. And I circled still. I highlighted it. And I put a question mark next to it. And it's written from the standpoint that 60 years ago, American women were heading off to the workplace in droves. But in the last couple of decades, that trend has completely stalled out. And they asked the question, what went wrong? And I went through and I circled all the words from what I would consider to be a progressive standpoint that number, 74% of women that are active in the workforce, isn't good enough for the writers of this article, and many who believe that we should be more like other countries so that we have 85 or 90 or 95% of the women working in the workforce outside of the home. Is that a bad thing that 26% of women choose not to work?
I don't think in and of itself it's a bad thing at all, Jerry. I think the only thing that is bad is if someone is not able to pursue what they want because of certain restraints that are built into the economy or built into the way the workforce functions. And what I mean by that is if a woman is trying to have more flex hours because she has a kid or needs family leave after she's had a baby, or the cost of childcare is so high in this country that it makes it almost cost prohibitive to go back to work or to work that That is part of the problem. So I think it's only problematic if this is going counter to what a woman herself desires to do, because we do live in a free country, and the hope is that each of us, man or woman, we can excel to our potential no matter what. So I think that's another issue that that particular article doesn't address in detail. It does mention very slightly the high cost of childcare, that that could be a problem. I know that they're sort of touting the European model, or at least, you know, the Netherlands and Finland, Iceland, Norway. They have much more family-friendly policies where men and women get maternity and paternity leave so that they can bond with their babies and have more flex time, and that they're paid to do this. And the article, I think, is pushing the fact that we don't have that kind of uniform family leave in this country, and even the people who do get to use it, that's only 58% of workers.
Right. Family and Medical Leave Act of 1993. Workers in the United States get 12 weeks of unpaid leave, but it only applies to about 58% of American workers, as you point out. But then they go to Sweden, where parents get 480 days of paid parental leave per child, with 88% of Swedish women participating in the labor force. I remember an exchange on Fox News with Megyn Kelly and one of, I think he's a contributor, I know he's a talk show host, Mike Gallagher. And Mike Gallagher was mocking the amount of time that Megyn Kelly took off to spend with her kid. And it was interesting because she's a Fox News person, and Fox News is about smaller government, less government intervention. You know, you're a rugged individualist, strike out on your own. But then Mike Gallagher struck out at her about the time that she took off. So she almost had to be a woman in the workforce more than she was a woman working for Fox News. And I thought it was a very interesting exchange because she got ticked at Gallagher, and Gallagher was trying to defend himself, and she wouldn't have any part of it.
Him down. And you know what? She was right. I mean, she's pregnant now, isn't it, with her third child?
Yeah.
I mean, the point is that studies have shown that when parents, both mother and father, especially in those first 3 months after childbirth, spend time at home bonding with their baby, that the child is healthier, better adjusted, more successful in the world, that studies have shown this. So that was what was really aggravating to her. And, you know, any woman who just gave birth to a child or is ready to give birth to her third is going to be offended at any man who has no such capability to, forgive me, pass a bowling ball through his private. You know, I mean, who is he to say what kind of rest she needs after having a baby, and for him to pretend that she is somehow being coddled after something like that? I would have gotten angry too if I were in her situation. What does he know about it? I mean, that really to me was a very condescending argument on his part. And here's my other point. I want to ask you about this. Do you think perhaps if we had a situation where we were more friendly toward families wanting paid medical leave and so on, to make their garden grow, as it were, that if we're spending more in terms of our resources, in terms of children when they're growing up, that would then pay us back in the future? Because then you grow up with kids who are better adjusted, better, you know, more inclined toward education, that make a better contribution to their society?
Yeah, I do. Because look how screwed up I am, and I was in an orphanage. So, you know, there's anecdotal evidence that you probably need to
believe it.
You need to spend a little time with your parental units. But yes, to a certain degree. But then, whose cost responsibility is it? No one. Is there a right to have children? Is it a birthright that you get your employer to pay you to have children, to be with your children, and to raise your children? It's an interesting dance between the two. I think 12 weeks is, asking a woman here, is 12 weeks, 3 months of paid leave to spend time with your kid, is that enough time, too little time, too much time? I think guys would probably think it's too much time. Women would probably think it's too little time. But Congress decided it's the right time.
Well, you know, it's impossible to answer that question, but that also goes along with the conservative line of thinking, in that nothing is cookie cutter. You know, you can't really establish a parameter that's going to work for everybody. The best you can do is try to come along with something that seems reasonable, and hopefully that is workable. But like I said, you know, more employers now are starting, they're just starting, it surprises me when I find this out, that they're starting to focus more on wellness and the happiness of their workers in the workforce, because if and when they do, they find that they are rewarded in the long run. So
sure.
Again, you know, I realize this may seem more of a liberal worldview, or we wonder who's, I get your point about who's responsible and who has to pay for this. You know, my husband and I, we don't have any kids. So to a certain extent, our tax dollars as homeowners are always going to education, but there is an argument to be made that that's paying us back, too, in society if these
right.
people are then going on to contribute. So I think that's really how one has to look at it. Employers who treat their employees crappy, you know what? A lot of their companies go under.
You know,
so I think that we have to look at that, too, that there is a reason to make your garden grow in that way.
And I agree with you that there isn't, there shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all, but there has to be at least a benchmark by which we start from. And it seems as if we're seeing a lot of people on a progressive movement side that are saying, we need to be more like Europe. We need to be more like Finland. We need to be more like Sweden. We need to be more like, we need to be more like. But at the last part of this article, they bury what I think is a real important part of the story that they don't point out early on, because most people don't read past paragraph 3 or paragraph 4, unless, of course, you're writing, unless of course you're writing something because you're a compelling writer. And you can read Anita Finley's stuff at epictimes.com, of which she's a contributor. But they say here, American women aren't losing out completely. Women in the United States who do work are more likely to make it into professional and managerial roles. They're also more likely to work full-time and as a result earn more money over their lifetimes. But according, again, to these progressive authors, that's not enough. They say we have to break through this work-family barrier to significantly increase participation. So they don't point out that over in Europe and Sweden and Finland and places in the EU that women are working, but many of them are working part-time, and most of them don't work their way up onto Mahogany Row. So even though we might have less women working here, we have women working in much more rewarding, financially rewarding, and powerful roles that has been a long time coming, but at least it's here.
Well, you know, I'm so glad you brought that up, Jerry, because there was just an article in the New York Times called When Leaning In Doesn't Pay Off. And their whole point was that a lot of women who are even getting these managerial roles in society now, they still do not attain the same level of satisfaction for men who have perhaps even symbolic authority in middle management, but who are not that powerful. And I think that brings us to a whole other side of the argument wherein women are still not rewarded socially, that we still look at a woman who wants to leave the home and not stay home with the kid and so on. If we look at her as bad somehow, or she is, there was an article in The Atlantic talking about this where they said, well, there's the woman with her hair pulled back in a tight bun, or as she called it, the ballerina bun, wearing a very severe pantsuit and, you know, being very harried at the office. And they paint her in this kind of an ugly, unattractive, strident kind of a way. And I think that we still have that sort of double standard in society, that even though women are able to excel here theoretically more than in some places, they're still not socially rewarded for doing so. But I will also point out that we have to remember that in terms of female leadership in this country, we rank 78th behind Uganda. And in terms of women being head in the boardroom, what is it, like 12%?
Right.
So, you know, I really debate that last finding about how much reward women are getting in the workplace.
Well, at least, you know, we look at the Chrissy Todd Whitman, we look at Meg Whitman. You know, there's a lot of people that have worked, a lot of women that have worked their way into high profile, powerful positions that are really starting to make their impact. But, you know, I look at it this way, Anita. You've got people in Washington, D.C. that like the dysfunction the way it is, and they don't want somebody new, black, white, male, female, coming in, Republican or Democrat, and changing the way things are done. And I think the same could be said for the boardroom, that there are a lot of good old boys that just like the way the system is, and they don't want to change, not necessarily because it's a woman, but because they like it the way it is, and they don't want anybody to upset what they know to be the status quo.
Well, bingo. Look what's going on with Janet Yellen and Larry Summers in terms of the choice for Fed chair.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty clear who Barack Obama wants. He wants Larry Summers.
Right. He wants Larry Summers. But there seems to be a push now, especially from the Asian countries, for Janet Yellen. And they are America's bankers at this point. So if you're going to make nice with the banker, you better listen to what the banker has to say. I have a feeling Larry Summers isn't going to get his day as the next Fed chair. I have a funny feeling Yellen is probably third on the list, But as you pointed out, with enough discussion and enough push, Janet Yellen has a good shot at being the next Fed chair. We got to take a break. Anita Finley, thanks for joining us on the program. Enjoy the Hamptons this weekend with the Clintons, making iced tea for them as they're tanning.
I will do so, and I'll be happy to bring my steamer trunk full of shoes.
Yes, I look forward to the photos. Anita Finley, thanks very much. Check out her book. It's called Dirty Words on Clean Skin. The book spent 16 weeks in the number one position on Amazon's Women in Politics list. And you can catch her writings at epictimes.com, where she is a prolific and insightful and creative and talented contributor. Anita Finley, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jerry. Have a great day.
You too. Stick with us. Be right back.